Excuse me, Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee to order Thursday, March 1st, 2012. Members, today is the agency bill from the MPCA, which I am the author. I will be staying at this end of the table. That's nothing really out of the normal, but we're going to have Mr. Knopf go through the bill for you, and there may be some amendments, I understand, and some discussion, some actions and whatnot. So any questions, members, as to how we're going to go about it? If not, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry.
Do we need to adopt the A1? Yes.
We should adopt the A1 amendment. That's correct, yes. Genius. Thank you. You'd so move?
Yes, I'd move it.
Senator Kielash moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1830. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right. Thank you, Senator. Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, I'll just walk through the bill and point out, especially a number of these provisions you've seen before, especially there were quite a few of them that were passed out of committee on Tuesday, but they're now all incorporated into 1830, which also includes provisions from the Pollution Control Agency. So I'll point those out when we get to them. The first section in this, sent out in Senate File 1839 on Tuesday. Section 2 was passed earlier this year in Senate File 1911. That was Senator Gazelka's bill dealing with the sale of game and fish licenses. Section 3 was passed out earlier in 1839. Section 4 was in 1839. And I won't do a lot of explaining on those that you've already passed out of committee. Section 5 was in 1889. Section 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Those are all. So now we're up to page 9. Section 13 was also in that in 1889. Section 14, this deals with the state parks. This was Senate File 1843, Senator Gazelka's bill. And that's just the language from that. The committee already passed that on to the Finance Committee.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf, there's been no changes from the bills that we passed in this delete all amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I will note where there's differences.
Okay.
But one place I should point out is the language was in Senator Gazelka's bill. The other one was decried. Senator Gazelka's bill on 2.28 to 2.29. It does include the title in the language in the subdivision rather than in the original bill. It was in a separate section. And because of this was put in an omnibus bill, I put the language in at the end dealing with the title, the citation. And again, I'll go back on the state park provision on page 10. This was actually Senator Kreis' bill, 1843, and it deals with keeping state parks open during the if there was a state shutdown again. Section 15 was in Senate File 1839. Section 16 was, and 17. This was another Senator DeKreif bill. Deals with keeping the zoo open if an appropriation bill hasn't been signed in time. So that's Section 17. That again was passed, and this is identical. Section 18 was also in Senate File 1839. Section 19 was in 1839. Section 20 was in 1839. Section 21 was also in 1839. Section 22 is a new section that you haven't seen before. This was in the PCA bill. And basically, it changes the water assessments and report. It removes the term biennial and allows them more flexibility in reporting to the Environmental Quality Board on their water assessments and reports. And now in Section 23, you've also seen this before, but this was earlier, a few weeks ago, Senator Dames' bill, 1885, dealing with local water planning. You're going to see a number of sections down here that are taken from 1885 as 1885 passed this committee. Section 23 is one of those. Section 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33 were all in Senator Dames' bill 1885. Section 34 is also a Senator Dames provision from from what we heard on Tuesday, but passed out of this committee. This was from Senate File 2042 dealing with wetlands, and this deals with the deed restriction. And then section, if we go all the way to page 24, you'll see also Senator Deem's other bill, Senate File 2072. And this has the provisions on dealing with the farmers that are under swamp buster. Section 36 was the amendment to Section 2 in Senator Deem's Bill 2042. And this includes the language that was in the amendment dealing with the de minimis exemptions. Section 37 is a new provision that was added as part of the discussion with Mr. Jaski on the bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would suggest an amendment. Apparently, just late before this hearing, the parties seem to have agreed not to include the written wetland violation complaint on 22.17 to 22.18. And maybe before we get too far in this, it might be good for somebody to move that. That was put in this draft, and Mr. Jaski from the board sent an email to several people last night, and then there's been some discussions today about that written wetland complaint. What they want to do is be able to just, when they request the evidence, if the board or local unit of government requests, or local unit of government technical evaluation panel or enforcement authority requests that document. So they would prefer not to have pursuant to a written wetland violation complaint included. So you would strike.
Mr. Chair, could we get
that, including the comma?
Could we get the page and line on that again,
please? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's page 27. It's 22.17 to 22.18.
Members, what you witnessed here today is actually somebody backing the clock up in St. Paul here. What you've actually witnessed is somebody actually backing the clock up in St. Paul with regards to explaining a bill. So if you have any questions, certainly either, you know, throw your hand out there or get a hold of me here. We're moving along very fast. But you were talking, Mr. Knopf, about page 27, lines 17 and 18. Is that correct?
That's exactly.
And somebody should make that.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins moves that. Did you want to explain that again, or is it pretty self-explanatory?
Mr. Knopf, I'm not exactly sure. Is it all the language in 17 and 18, or just?
Mr. Chair, it would be everything after the period on line 17 and everything before evidence on 18.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Now that I've moved to delete that, could we have a little background on why they didn't want to actually have a written complaint? Do we know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, there were some concerns about receiving written wetland complaints, and also this tied it into that it could only ask for it if there was a written complaint.
That's okay. Senator Higgins renews her motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, good. Proceed.
Hey, Mr. Chair, we'll move on to Section 38 on the bottom of page 27. That was, again, in Senator Deem's 2042, and that has to do with the main part of it deals with basically wetland banking for agricultural land. And also Section 39 was in Senator Deem's bill. Sections 40 and 41 are new. They're an initiative of the chair. And what it does is these were enacted just a few years ago where people who are appropriating water need to provide for water monitoring equipment. They have to actually install the equipment, pay for the equipment, and pay for the maintenance of the equipment. And what this says is that they are not required to drill for additional wells for the purpose of the monitoring and evaluation. They would use existing wells, and they would not have to pay for the additional wells. And that's basically what 40 and 41 do.
Mr. Chair?
As part of that appropriation permit.
Mr. Chair, so
Mr. Kielash.
Is this going to limit the water, whoever's, I'm not even sure, the Pollution Control Agency's ability to monitor what's going on with their aquifers?
That would be DNR, I believe.
Or DNR?
Would you like to ask them?
I'd like to, yeah, just get an explanation of it. So.
Mr. Hirsch is here today.
A lot of stuff we made over.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Steve Hirsch, DNR Director of Ecological and Water Resources. And as Mr. Knopf said, the impact of the sections 40 and 41 would be that in situations where we need to require additional monitoring to monitor the aquifer, we would not be able to include the drilling of the well, which is the major expense in such an endeavor if a new well is needed. And we've got major concerns with these provisions. Just to provide a little bit of background, sustainable groundwater use is a major issue facing the state, and it's going to become more of an issue as projected population growth occurs. And it's a major impediment right now, lack of groundwater information to achieving sustainable use. And we've got literally thousands of aquifers in the state where we don't have good information because we've got little or no monitoring data. Now, there's an important distinction, I think, to make here. And one is that we've got a statewide network of monitoring wells. It's not large enough to track long-term trends in groundwater. And that, we believe, it's appropriate for that to be funded with public dollars because we're trying to track the long-term well-being of these aquifers. But then there's also a more short-term need to monitor the impacts of large water withdrawals. And we really need to do that in order to prevent, you know, new wells from creating water use conflicts with adjacent water users. And here we believe it's appropriate for the water users to share in the cost of that monitoring. And the effects, when you pump water from a well, the effects are not limited to the property boundaries of the well owner. It's quite often that you have effects on other people or effects on surface water. So in essence, what this bill does is it puts us in the position, if we get a request for a new well, of either having to say no because we don't know what the impacts will be if we don't have a good monitoring well for that aquifer, or else allowing the permit and have no way to take a proactive approach if water use conflicts start to occur. And when we've been in this position before where we haven't been able to monitor the way we need to, and it really sets the stage for conflicts. You get well interference, somebody's well goes dry, and then also with impacts of surface water, all of a sudden a wetland dries up and nobody knows why. And then inevitably the department bears the cost of getting its staff out to run down what the problem is and figure out how to correct it. And give you a good recent example of one that happened with the city of Hugo a few years ago. They wanted a new water supply well that was 3 miles from White Bear Lake. We required them to do a monitoring well. They didn't like it, but ultimately they did it. And now the USGS, which is studying the water levels on White Bear Lake, is telling us is that their water supply well may actually be one of the issues that's affecting the low water levels on White Bear Lake, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. So, you know, we recognize that the cost of these wells can be high, and we do actively work with large water users to look for abandoned wells or to look for opportunities where we can use an existing well for monitoring, but that just isn't always possible. And so we do need to be able to have the option of requiring new monitoring wells. And in those cases where we do, we really look for opportunities for that cost to be shared, so we're not requiring one for each permit. So just to summarize, then we really think that the large water users need to be active partners in helping us to monitor groundwater levels in case where there's potential for conflict. And we really think this provision has the potential to really do all parties involved a disservice, because it'll either put us in a position where we have to deny permits or else approve permits and kind of hold our breath and hope nothing bad happens. So,
Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hirsch. You're saying that there's only two options. Well, there might be another option, and that is you can put the well in, but the watershed or the wider community who's interested in the knowledge would actually pay for it or be at least part of it. You know, I think the key word that you're using there is share the cost. The way I'm reading the current law is the landowner has to pay for the well, and there's not any sharing going on. So I don't know. I think that you need to go back and rethink of what you're doing with regard to these monitoring wells. It's good to have them in there, but I don't think that the landowner should have to pay 100% of the cost either. So it seems to me that there is another option besides just saying no or not knowing.
Senator Scoy, I have to echo that very, very issue. That was going to be my question. And Mr. Hirsch, the information that's going to be gathered from the, as you say, the provider here or the appropriator, in other words, the farmer out in a Timbuktu that's going to have an irrigator and maybe he's the only one within 2 or 3 miles to get that information. Why would you need that information? I guess you did explain that, but if it were that crucial, I guess I have to echo the same sentiments that Mr. Scoy has, Senator Scoy, about if the city or a county or a watershed would want to know that information, wouldn't they do their own testing? Why wouldn't they, I guess?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoia, it gets into a somewhat philosophical policy discussion, and I certainly see arguments both ways. But I guess the counter to that would be the need for the monitoring arises because you've got a large private water user that wants to take the water. And those are the kinds of situations we're looking for. We're not just slapping in monitoring well or requiring people to slap in monitoring wells every chance we get. But when we have a concern that a large water user is going to take water and potentially cause concerns with adjacent landowners that would not be there otherwise, then those are situations where I would guess that the local government unit, watershed district, county, wherever, would be reluctant to absorb those costs as well.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, one of my questions is how often do we require monitoring wells? Is this something that's going on many times annually, et cetera? Just to give me an idea how prevalent the problem is for this.
Mr. Chairman, Hirsch. Senator Kielash, I think I'll have Mr. Luthi, our deputy director, is a little bit more familiar with some of those details. So.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
My name is Dave Luthi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Ecological Water Resources. In answer to that question is that we are seeing more situations now where it's not just the individual well itself that is causing problems, but actually the collective actions of multiple appropriators on that aquifer, and we're starting to see water levels start to decline and affect either other users or other uses. And so the challenge that we're facing now is not so much what we would expect of the individual, but we're trying to understand what the collective impact of multiple users are on that system. And so we would, and that the purpose of this law that was 282 is that to have a situation where we could have additional wells installed that would potentially be paid for by multiple users to help understand the system rather than those costs being borne by the individual.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up, please?
Yes, follow up.
And so you currently have the ability to have multiple payers on a monitoring well without burdening one landowner at this time. So this would just prevent you from doing any kind of monitoring wells without charging folks.
Mr. Luthi?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, as of the session before this or when 282 was adopted, that enabled us to actually be able to look at broader situations so that we didn't have to deal with just individuals when it was a multiple impact problem. And so we've had that legislation for a short period of time. We've only used it in one situation so far, but we will have more and more situations where the demand is increasing and the impacts across multiple users needs to be coming into play so that it's not just one individual that needs to be that we're dealing with when attempting to resolve the problem.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess members, I mean, this isn't about whether there's going to be a monitoring well or not. This is about who's going to pay for it. And when you listen to what they're talking about, there are multiple facilities and communities and farmers putting wells down and drawing water, and that multiple users should be paying for it, not just the one individual, person who's appropriating on this one specific point. I'm not opposed to I think the monitoring wells are needed, and the question is who's going to pay for it, and it should be paid for on a broader basis than just the landowner in these appropriation situations.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, but the way I read this, it doesn't say to spread it out. It just says that you can't build just one person for it. It doesn't set in place a plan to actually have the multiple users pay it, or am I missing something?
Well, Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think that would be for the DNR to work forward, but in this situation, they're not allowing them to build the one appropriator to drill the additional well. But the monitoring well can still occur. It's just who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think one of the things is that you're asking the community or a group to pay for something that a benefit that one individual may be getting out of, depleting the aquifers for their own profits. I mean, they're pumping the water on whatever for a profit. And to say that the community should share the cost of making sure that, you know, the aquifer isn't drained for everybody else in the community when there's one large user like that is not appropriate. Why should the community have to pay for this one person that's profiting from the essentially overuse of them?
Senator Kielash, the community's probably drawing out of the aquifer for their drinking water, and very likely a number of rural residents are also. I mean, there's lots of uses going on here. It's not just this one specific appropriator. It's lots of uses. These aquifers are large. I mean, think about the size of the ones that we have concerns with heading up into toward Senator Gazelka's district. These are large areas. There's a lot of concern there, obviously, and we want monitoring wells, but I don't think it's fair to just have the one individual bear that cost.
Mr. Clavin, maybe you could come forward and give us a little different light on the subject here. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Irrigators Association of Minnesota, and this is an initiative that we support. We have talked to the department about this as well. The situation came a couple of weeks ago at our annual meeting. A member was telling us that he went to renew his appropriations permit for the year, and as part of the permit, the department required two monitoring wells on his property. The cost was $20,000. You'll see in the existing language on 28.19, the commissioner may, and that's some discretion now that's being exercised in that one case. As the gentleman mentioned, this law came in 2010, so it's just starting, and we're just starting to see this. So he talked to the association about that, and the concern by the members what this is going to start happening a lot, where a farm goes to get its irrigation permit and then has to put all in all this cost. They don't object to the information. They don't object to the monitoring. They want the data just like everybody else. The question is about the cost. DNR does have many monitoring wells. It's either hundreds or maybe even thousands of a system around the state, and all the information is shared with everybody who draws on the aquifer. And so our point is not to stick one farm with the bill. They want the information. They don't object to the monitoring. It's, like you said, a question about who pays.
Mr. Hirsch, your response to that, or Deputy Commissioner?
This is Dave Luthy again. In answer to that, Mr. Chairman, is that the department has always had the ability to require individuals when their individual appropriation was impacting either others or causing a problem to require monitoring. And so that's been on the books for a long time in our rules. And so in this 282 that was passed a couple sessions ago, we said we were no longer in a situation where we could solve all the issues for the whole aquifer by managing just with the individual. And so we asked for the language to be changed to enable us to have multiple users be able to pay for the costs of monitoring the aquifer rather than being a situation, as Mr. Clavin has talked about, where an individual would have to pay for that. And so the intent of 282 originally was not to cause individuals to have to pay for it, but it enabled us to have multiple users be able to pay for it. And if it would be a city or irrigators or whoever's on that same system, if they're putting stress on the system, it ends up that we need to manage that effectively with everybody who's drawing from the system being able to understand what the impacts are. And so that's the purpose of 282 in its current form. If it's amended, it removes our ability to do that. So
explain to me then what Mr. Clavin just testified to about the mini test drills that the DNR does have. How do you go about doing that? Why do you do that, and who pays for that?
Mr. Chairman, we have a statewide observation well network. We have approximately 700 wells in the state to kind of keep track of long-term trends, not of what people are impacting of, but in general what's happening in the aquifers as a whole. As Mr. Hirsch indicated, we probably have over 1,000 or more different types of aquifers around the state. And so we don't have a very adequate system in the first place to know what's going on. But in this particular case that we're talking about here, we're talking about when there are situations where demand has increased to the point we're seeing impacts that can affect others, is that we need more information in those situations to understand how we should manage that limited supply amongst multiple users so that's sustainable. And so We don't have information, and we'll never have enough information to manage specific hot spots where there's a lot of pressure or more demand on the system or there's limited, and we will need at some point in the future, particularly as demands are increasing and supplies are limited, to have that ability to work with the users and the community to say, we have a limited supply, where should we put some wells so we can manage it, monitor it. We'd like that to be done locally as much as possible so that we're not in the middle of that. They help understand how they manage that system, and this the monitoring requirements that we're talking about are designed to help spread those costs amongst all users, not so that it's targeted to individuals. And in the particular case example is that he brought up is that I don't believe that we've required anybody to pay a $20,000 bill. Somebody asked the question of how much a monitoring nest of wells might cost, and the number was $20,000. But that's not what we asked an individual to do yet. But we would look at the situation. If their individual impact was causing problems, we would have to look and see what it would be necessary for that. But if it's part of a larger system, we wouldn't expect that individual to take care of the responsibility for everybody else either.
Have you been receiving or have you received clean water money legacy money at all for any of this, or my just give me an idea where the funding is.
Mr. Chairman, in the current biennium, we did receive, I believe, $3 million to start doing more intensive groundwater management work for what we would call groundwater management areas, where we help people understand the aquifers underneath them, the supplies, and the information about how to manage them better. We're just starting on that process, and we will have been working in some areas already to help people understand that. Before that, we've gotten some limited money for county groundwater atlases, which are designed to help us understand the geology underneath us so that we can make better decisions. And so those are the sources that we have typically gotten from Clean Water Fund to help understand the system in the first place.
Thank you. Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I didn't catch your name.
My name is David Luthy.
Luthy? Mr. Luthy. So the purpose of 282 is to do exactly what I think I want to have done, which is to share the cost of these monitoring wells among a broader group of appropriators to all the people that are using the watershed, which makes all the sense to me in that we should head toward. Why did we have testimony today that we have a $20,000 bill going to one farmer when you just said that that didn't happen? So we've got a little conflict here we need to sort out.
Mr. Luthy, can you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scully, there are increasing problems, and we have talked to irrigators or individual users about needs for additional monitoring. There's not been a $20,000 price tag asserted on anybody as far as I'm aware of, and we are talking more about, I'd need more details about what specific situation that has been referred to here, but I'm not aware of where we have placed that type of bill on somebody just recently. So,
Mr. Claven.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. The department didn't require the bill. The information they gave me at the annual meeting was that this was a condition of the permit, and that's what led to the legislative fix.
A condition of what?
Of receiving the permit for this year. So you get your annual appropriations permit, and what they're saying, what the guy said was, this is now a condition of the permit that you have to install two monitoring wells. I don't know where they are. I suppose one in each end of the property. And that the condition of the permit led to the quote, which led to what he's facing in order to get his appropriations permit for the year. So it wouldn't be that the department sends the bill. It would be the requirement to put these in. It'd be private cost.
Mr. Luthy.
Chairman Ingebrigtsen, I believe that if I'm understanding this correctly, there is an area up in the west of Park Rapids near the Strait River at Trout Stream where somebody may have applied for a permit to take more water from the groundwater, and the pumping of that well would potentially impact the base flow in the Trout Stream, and we may have said that there would be some monitoring that would be required in order to understand the potential impacts of that type of appropriation that close to a Trout Stream.
Senator Scoy? No? Question?
Well, I guess it seems to me that this sounds to me like everybody's kind of in agreement, but the language doesn't do what we want it to do in the current law, and maybe not in the fix, so maybe we need to work on this a little bit. But I think when you have these large water aquifer issues, the broader community should be supporting the monitoring, not just one individual landowner. I mean, he might be the new well on the block, but he's not the only one. There are other ones, and they all impact comparably.
And if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Luthi, you see that mechanism is in place for a group of people, a group of utilizing wells, a group of people. There is a mechanism in place for them to pay for this monitoring well?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's what our intent and understanding of why we asked for 202 to be amended the way it currently is now before is the new request was to do just that.
Okay. Members, Mr. Knopf's got a possible fix here. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to get at Senator Scoy's point, on 28.23, before appropriator, you could insert the term individual or single, but I've got individual. And then on line 28.24, before the period, as a condition of receiving the permit.
Members understand that?
Oh, could you repeat it again, please?
Mr. Chair, it's 28.23, before appropriator, insert individual. And on 28.24, before the period, insert as a condition of receiving the permit.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Scoy?
Yeah, no, that looks good. I'd move that.
Senator Scoy moves that amendment. Everybody understand the amendment? Senator DeJean?
Can you repeat it one more time, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, 28.23, before appropriator, insert individual. And on 28.24, before the period, insert as a condition of receiving the permit.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Luthi, does this give you the appropriate language to be able to continue doing this, or Mr. Hirsch?
Mr. Chairman, Hirsch. Senator Kielash, this language would definitely be an improvement, but the point I would make is there still could be, and Senator Scoy is correct in many cases, it's going to be multiple users, but there still could be a situation where, depending on the placement of the well, it's an individual appropriator. That's the example that Mr. Luthi just gave. If it's close to a trout stream, it may be that single appropriator would be the one that we would be concerned about, and not adjacent appropriators. So it would work in a lot of cases, this language, but I'm afraid we would still run into situations then where we couldn't require a monitoring well where we would need to.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hirsch, from my experiences with the DNR, you guys are pretty good at saying no. If it doesn't fit, then just say no and let the applicant figure something out. But I think that this is an improvement to get to what we really want to have, which is a greater group paying for these monitoring wells, and you'll get the information, but the cost will be spread more fairly.
Members, any other questions of the Scoy Amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Thank you. Good discussion. Mr. Knopf, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, we can move on to page 29. And this is section 42 is something that was in the Pollution Control Agency bill. They want to move a report on groundwater monitoring to every 5 years instead of every even numbered year. Instead of biennially, we go to every 5 years. Section 43, this is related to Senator Peterson's bill, Senate File 1860. The language is a little different. It's my understanding that there were a couple of things that happened as far as what was with the people doing these concrete, the diamond cutters on the concrete highways. And so what this would do is basically put a definition in Chapter 115 of a concrete washout to mean only untreated wash water used in a concrete mixer or concrete pump rinse-out operation. So that would apply to all of the Pollution Control Agency's permits and rules related to concrete washouts. And so that was, I think, one of the areas where what would cause some concern in the 2008 general permit that was issued for this. And it looked like it was intended only for this, but it was broader than that. And then so that's one part. You'll see later on there'll be another part related to Senator Peterson's bill, Senate File 1860. In Section 44, the citizen monitoring of water quality, you'll see on page 30 that the they're going to move to also going to, well, this will be a four-year report rather than a biennial report for that from the agency. That was, again, new from the agency's report. And then in Section 45, their long-range plan, this basically removes the requirement that they report to the legislature. They'll prepare a long-range plan, but there is no reporting requirement. In Section 46, this deals with e-waste. And if you look on page 31, you'll see that there was supposed to be an annual report for this, but on 31.22 to 31.23, they'll include it in the toxic pollution prevention report, which we're going to get to later. I think it's 4 years, but we'll get there later on as to when that report is due. They're changing the date on that, too, but they would include it in their toxic pollution prevention report for e-waste rather than every year. And then, Mr. Chair and members, you'll see on page 32, you have the State Energy Office and the PCA, Commissioner of Commerce through the Energy Office, submit recommendations regarding operations. So this is the State Resource Recovery Program that would eliminate that report. Section 48 is a Solid Waste Management Policy Report. Currently, it's a biennial report, and this would make it a quadrennial report, and that will be again, you'll see some sections later that are going to be we're making it conform to this because they already include some provisions from other reports into this consolidated policy report that they deliver. But it would be every 4 years instead of every 2 years.
It's the president.
The phone is ringing.
It's the president.
I'm sure it's a wrong number. Mr. Chair.
didn't Jimmy Carter call it for the surgery?
He might have.
Sorry about the distraction.
Mr. Chair, on page 34, we have section 49. It's, again, a pollution control agency provision. And this deals with supplementary recycling goals. And what this does is removes some specific provisions for getting percentage points to apply, you know, for yard waste collection and things like that to apply towards those supplementary recycling goals. Section 50 deals with interim monitoring of each county towards the recycling goals. And then basically what this does is it was a biennial report, and now they're going to be, it'll be part of their solid waste policy report, which will be a quadrennial report. You can see it already was supposed to be a part of it, the language being stricken on 35.6. This just clarifies that it'll be part of that report, but it's every 4 years, not every 2 years. The same can be said with Section 51. It's already included in the policy report, and it eliminates the every 2 year provision because that will now be an every 4 year report. Section 52, this deals with the toxic pollution prevention plans for those people who are required to submit them. We're going to change now that prior to this, they were submitted to the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and we're putting the Commissioner of Public Safety receiving those toxic pollution prevention plans. And you'll see Section 52, there are a number of subdivisions where we're changing Commissioner to Commissioner of Public Safety to be clear that it's going to be going to the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Mr. Chair, can we get an explanation for that change?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I can. I think that this was a part of the agency bill, and I think if somebody from the agency wants to get up and explain their provisions.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair and committee members, my name for the record is Kirk Adelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And just a little bit of background on this provision. This was actually a change made in the mid-90s under Governor Carlson to try to streamline reports that were being done. So that was initially being reported in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The date was changed, and the department getting it is now the Department of Public Safety. At that time, it was also a legislative change to be made. However, for some reason, it was not made. And every governor since then, by executive order, has made this change so that it would be easier on the responsible parties to submit the data to one source. And the Department of Public Safety is a better collection site for this data.
Thanks, Bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, we're just updating law to current practice.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's good to know.
And, Mr. Chair, Section 53, the PCA has been required to do an annual pollution report. This will change it to a biennial pollution report, so on each even-numbered year. And on April 1, they're supposed to be reporting to the legislature on pollution in the state. Section 54, this is that other section I mentioned earlier with Senator Peterson on the diamond grinding and saw slurry, and this would specifically exempt that from the definition of solid waste in our solid waste laws. Section 55, this was part of the PCA bill. This is extending the ban on open-air swine basins another 5 years. There was an ending date of 2012 in that, and this would extend it another 5 years. Section 56, this deals with the Pollution Control Agency long-range plan, and it basically makes a number of changes on the long-range plan, similar to what they did for the waste plan, and basically they don't report that to the legislature. They just work on that long-range plan themselves. I mean, they are going to be reporting on a quadrennial basis on these issues, but not requiring the long-range plan to be part of that. And then, again, on the 116C833, this deals with the low-level radioactive waste, and we have an interstate commission, although it hasn't really been active since we've been able to ship it off to other states now. They were talking about cutting that back, and so the commission's been pretty inactive. But this one, under current law, requires a biennial report, and this would make it every 4 years. And then, Mr. Chair, Section 58 is a technical provision, and it relates to the biobutanol being added on the environmental review. And this was part of the agency bill. We have seen this, but the bill Senator Saxhoggs, which is now in Senator Ingebrigtsen's 1567, included this also. But it's a technical change on page 39 that the agency requested. It was just, an update from last year's bill to make sure when we're talking about this EAW exemption that we also refer to biobutanol facilities. And then, Mr. Chair, on page 59, this is the solar and biomass resources report from Commerce and PCA. And what this does is to change it from an annual report to a biennial report. Section 60, this deals with progress report, and this is for greenhouse gas emissions. And you'll see some new language on page 42, on lines 42.4 to 42.7. And what this is it's just recodified. You'll see later on there's a provision that's stricken, and I think that was an annual report, and this is going to a biennial report, but they're adding this in to this other report rather than having two reports in two different places. So the language you see there is basically recodified and then also made into a biennial report. Section 61 deals with Section 61 and 62 are kind of combined. They're basically metropolitan area waste abatement reports and landfill abatement reports. And what this does is it's kind of technically cleaning up who gets the report and then taking out the dates for the report so that there isn't a clear time. But it does say that they're supposed to be part of the agency's waste policy report that will be due every 4 years. You can see on 42.20, you can see that the reference to that report. So it will be part of their quadrennial report on waste policy, but not necessarily every year or every odd numbered year. And then you'll see the same for the next section in 62, although it does have they have to submit a report on contingency trust fund activities every year. So we would continue that annual report for the contingency trust, action trust. That's a specific fund that's paid into in the metropolitan area for landfill contingency action trust activities. Section 63 we saw the other day in Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill dealing with eliminating the report, a report on the land records management system. Section 64, now this was Senator Carlson's bill dealing with, and this was again heard in committee a few days ago, dealing with subsurface sewage treatment systems. I modified it slightly after talking with some people, and I'll show you what we did. You added the sentence that day on 45.20 to 45.23, And the only change that I made in, after talking with some of the interested folks afterwards, there was a concern that, it's the latter sentence. It's 45.23 to 45.25. Mm-hmm. I chose the word begin on 45.24 because there was concern that this could be interpreted as only allowing him during that time period. I don't think it'd be interpreted that way, but just to be clear, we just say that they can begin to do that even prior to a county adopting it, that towns and cities can begin exercise. I don't know if everybody remembers the discussion that day, but there was some concern that Mr. Johnson brought up with this provision in here that cities and towns wouldn't be able to exercise their authority. And I just wanted to make, this is very technical, but I wanted to make sure I point out that is a change from what was adopted the other day in committee. And it was more to clarify that it's their authority continues after those county rules are adopted. And then, Mr. Chair, Section 65, again, that was in the bill that was heard the other day dealing with the LCCMR project on linking habitat restoration to bioenergy. The Department of Natural Resources requested it. Section 66 was in that bill that deals with having dogs off leash in the new LaSalle Lake recreation area. Section 67 was again part of that bill dealing with the extension of the LCCMR appropriations. And then Section 68, a portion of that was heard. There are some additional repealers. Everything through on 48.20 through 103G 705 subdivision 1 was included. The other ones are new, 115.447, 115.07, and so on. And then also the rule provisions, but you do have in your packet a listing or basically the language from all of those repealers. I put in there an appendix to the statutory references. And then, so you can see that if you look at the appendix, starting on page 2R, you can see the provisions that are being repealed. The first PCA one is a tracking report for new wastewater systems. The second one is a biennial report on the operations and activities of the agency. The third one is 115.815 subdivision 5 is a state government resource recovery report. Section 115A965 is a report on toxic packaging. And then 216H.07 subdivision 4 is the annual legislative proposal. That was the one I mentioned earlier that was being recodified and made into a biennial rather than an annual report. And then there are also a number of agency rules. I don't think I need to go over those specifically unless somebody has questions, and then maybe the agency would be better to answer those. But there are a number of rules that the agency has requested to be repealed by law, and those are also in an appendix labeled GK0030. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end
Thank
of the
Thank you. Rule. Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Any questions, members? Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. I'm not sure when the appropriate time would be for
this
that.
This would be the time. We'll get that amendment passed out, and when you're doing that, Mr. Knopf, could you explain the term used for 5 years? You got annual, biannual. What's the term you use for a five-year report?
Mr. Chair.
This is going to be a test. Oh, yeah, she
is. Mr. Chair, I was looking that up last night as I was working on a summary for this, and I thought, but I decided not to use it in my summary because it's an archaic word that, well, it's not used very much. In fact, the Microsoft Word Dictionary didn't include that term. But it's a quinquennial.
And, Mr. Chair, on these repealers, are these all agency repealers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielesh, yes.
Do you have any questions, Senator Kielesh?
That was it.
Okay. Senator Carlson, the...
I'm not sure if this has a number.
I'm not sure it does either. What number do you have?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's just a GK0029.
Okay.
It was done before the document was finished, so that it's just a blank. But we'll fit it in. It's not a problem.
To the GK0029 amendment, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, what we really need to do is have a. This amendment would allow for a Forest Resources Council to do a study. We have a problem getting enough wood out of the woods. whether it's at the state level, federal level, and we have a lot of private land that, you know, sometimes we have some incentives that they work, they don't work. What we really wanted to do, I was approached by members of the Forestry Affairs Council and others that they're perfectly delighted to pay for this study, so it won't cost the state anything, but to do this study, report back to the state, evaluate the existing and potential financial incentives for private forest land management. And so we can make sure that we're getting good, proper use of any incentives, any programs out there to incentivize individuals to manage their forest lands in a way that's good for hunting, good for fishing, good for the ecology, and good for producing timber for our fourth largest industry in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Carlson, I know Senator Higgins is going to ask the question about the members receiving this report, and Mr. Knopf, maybe you can help us with that. You certainly want the majority as well as the minority, or is that addressed in this?
Going to the whole committee.
Yeah, yes, just going to the whole committee, that covers it then.
I have another question.
Yeah, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, is this a one-time report, or is this biennial, quadrennial, or quintennial?
Yeah, good question.
Mr. Chair
good
and question, Senator Higgins, Carlson. It's a one-time. Okay, thank you.
1 year?
Just 1 year.
Mr. Chair. Any further questions, members? Senator Keelash.
Is there going to be a fiscal note in this?
I believe Senator Carlson said it was going to be paid for.
Mr. Chair and Senator Keelash, interested parties, and perhaps Wayne
Forest Research Council.
Maybe Mr. Brandt would want to speak to that if
sure.
He's willing.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Just briefly, you know, kind of the whole world for these types of programs has changed. I think the last time this was looked at in a comprehensive way was 10 or 12 years ago. The fiscal situations in government have changed. A lot of the ownership of the forests have changed, large tracts and small tracts. And, you know, we think that the Forest Resources Council and Dave Zemeta, the executive director of that, is here, and I serve on that council also, would do well to take a look at those programs, see what's working, see what needs to be thrown out, see what needs to be streamlined, see what can be improved. And we're, you know, as I've said to Senator Carlson and to Executive Director Zemeta, you know, we understand, I mean, we're prepared to contribute to the cost of the study. So.
Senator Keelash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brandt. Do we really need legislation to make this happen?
Well,
it seems like we could just go ahead and do the study or with the resources available. Or
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keelash, you know, the Forest Resource Council has done a number of studies that have come through these committees in the past. They're currently doing some on riparian issues, have done a number of them, did one on recommendations from MCAG, the Climate Change Advisory Group. And so they've always kind of run through here. So hence we asked, working with the council, asked Senator Carlson to offer the amendment. Gives it a little more force, you know, brings it back here with the recommendations.
Any further questions? Senator Saxon.
Well, I was just going to say, make comment for Senator Keelash that, as somebody said before here, Mr. Brandt, that Forest Resource Council is running an appropriation from us, so I think this is appropriate to put this in.
Thank you.
Okay. Question I would have, Mr. Knopf, on the amendment here, obviously page so and after line one, can you insert that in the amendment before we move forward? Or is that's not clear,
Mr. Chair. It's not necessary, but if you want, I can find a place in the bill to put it in. We often do this with omnibus bills where the draft of the amendment, the main amendment, isn't finished yet, and people want to get amendments to it, and especially when it's a separate section. This just gets fit in and engrossing.
Okay, just making a note of that so everybody knows. Okay. Anything further on the Carlson amendment? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Members, I do have another amendment It's the A2 amendment. I think we're going to pass that out. This was a concern that was brought to me by Senator Newman, who has some constituents in his area that have some concerns about this section. And I guess I would call on this at this time and call on Senator Newman and his folks for some testimony with regards to the A2 amendment. Give a couple minutes, Senator Newman here, let everybody look at it quick. Also, we're going to be handing out a letter with regards to that. We'll have staff hand that out. But members, again, Senator Newman, welcome to the committee. We'll let you address the my A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Newman. I'm a senator from Meeker and McLeod County. Mr. Chairman and members, a couple of days ago, I was contacted by some of my constituents. Immediately to my left is the manager of Glencoe Power and Light, Mr. David Meyer, who had emailed me with some concerns relative to proposed actions by the PCA regarding solid waste disposal. Shortly thereafter, I received an email from a man that I've known for a very long time that works for McLeod County and is involved in environmental concerns with McLeod County. And the email that I received from Mr. Holman indicated that the commissioner of the MPCA is contemplating enforcing a statute that would cost McLeod County in excess of $500,000 a year. Now, $500,000 to a county like McLeod County is really a lot of money. And I then had a phone call or a phone conversation with Mr. Meyer concerning his concerns with the contemplated action by the commissioner. And in a nutshell, and I'm going to have Mr. Meyer outline this for you in more detail, but in a nutshell, just outside of Glencoe, just a few miles, there is a solid waste facility where they produce methane gas. And Glencoe Power and Light utilizes a great deal of that methane gas for the production of electricity in the city of Glencoe. And as I understand it, what's being contemplated is they're going to truck the solid waste from the Glencoe area to someplace else, maybe Elk River. And I will tell you, members, that it is of great concern to me and my constituents in McLeod County if the commissioner proceeds with the action that has been proposed. And with that, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd ask Mr. Meyer to identify himself for the record and enlighten you a little bit further.
Mr. Meyer, welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Meyer. I'm the general manager with the Glencoe Light and Power Commission in Glencoe, Minnesota. The Glencoe Light and Power Commission in 2007 was part of building a facility, the Spruce Ridge Energy, our gas to energy facility, just outside of Glencoe. As we're well aware, in 2007, Minnesota initiated a renewable energy standard of 25% renewables by 2025. This facility was originally built with 2,400 kW of energy available. In 2010, due to having enough land gas capabilities, they increased production to 3.2 megawatt, 3,200 kW. The Glencoe Light and Power purchases all this energy, and thanks to this renewable source, we were able to serve our customers with 33.6% renewable energy from this facility in 2011. Our concern right now is the potential actions by enforcing this statute further would decrease the amount of municipal mixed solid waste that goes to the Spruce Ridge landfill facility, thereby decreasing the amount of methane gas and adversely affecting the production of this renewable resource.
Okay, members, any questions? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why, I don't, whoever could answer it, why are they proposing to reduce the waste stream? What's the rationale? I mean, what's the law that was changed that MPCA is enforcing that's reducing the waste streams of your facility?
We're also going to hear from the MPCA as well, I think, and my, I guess, Kurt, you're going to be coming up. But go ahead, sir, did you have?
Hello, my name is Mike Berkepek. I am the Minnesota chapter chairman for the National Solid Waste Management Association. I'm also a hauler. I work for ACE Solid Waste. The mandatory processing law is something that's been out there for 27 years, and it applies to metro area waste. So I believe the concern, and I may be corrected on that, is that there's metro area waste going to this landfill that may not go to this landfill anymore.
Senator Scoy, that's clear?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I've got it. It's a separation issue is what's going on, I assume.
Okay. You and I certainly know about the renewable standards, Mr. Senator Scoy, 2007. Is somebody from the agency here to testify? Maybe you can make room there if you could, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. If there's any further questions, we'll call on your witnesses. Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, in the committee for record, again, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Just to provide a little background here, there is a restriction on disposal of metropolitan-produced waste in landfills. It's in statute 473.848, and it specifically states that before waste can be taken to a landfill, it needs to be taken to a processing facility. And so we have right now a certain amount of waste that is still excess capacity in the metro area that's not being fulfilled, so the law is not being met. This is a law that's been on the book for a while. The MPCA recently has started to put together a straw proposal on what it would look like to enforce that policy that's been passed by previous legislators and moving forward with it. And during that process, we have started in doing our due diligence by going out to talk to those who would be affected by the change. That includes landfill operators, haulers, local communities, including that those that you heard today. So as we're discussing and expressing what this straw proposal would look like, we are getting comments to move to take into as we make this decision. At this point, there's no date on the calendar that's circled that anything is changing at this point. It is a book. It is a law on the books that the legislature and previous governor passed, and as an agency, we do have to follow the state's law. So we are looking into this and finding out where there are the what ripples there may be from this effect, and we're hearing of them now. And that's that we'll take that information into our consideration as we continue to move on, and we're examining some of those questions that are in the report right now and how this would go forward. But again, ultimately, this is a law on the book that is not being met at this point.
Mr. Cadell, could you please explain to the committee how long ago this law was passed, and how many times have you been enforcing that law until this point?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I do not have the date, but
85. Senator Higgins is saying 85. Does that sound right?
My first year. I will defer to the committee on that. I don't have the exact date. This has been an issue, and over the years, there has been, back in 97, the gap of capacity was much smaller. Within the recent period of time, that gap of excess capacity or waste that should be being processed before going to landfill has increased. And as that continues to widen, that creates a number of problems, which makes the implementation of the law even more important and puts that in the question of what we should do moving forward.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kiddell, is this Bill, is this language jumping the gun on the rulemaking process because it restricting your ability to finish your evaluation about what needs to happen? It seems like they're responding to inquiry rather than to actual direction. Is that accurate?
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is correct. We're still collecting information on this. We've met with various groups. We're always looking for input on the straw proposal on what could those actual technical details and what could make it better. If there are better alternatives, we are looking at those issues also. But fundamentally, the law is on the books by previous legislatures, and we are looking to see what it would mean to enforce it.
Mr. Chair, I know there's some folks here from Hennepin County Waste Management that have some concerns over this language. Could we have them?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Actually, my name is Trudy Richter. I am here on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which represents the six metro counties, including Hennepin County. And I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association, which represents all the public and private interests in waste to energy in the state. I'd like to say first, the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board and the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association's primary, number one legislative priority is to preserve 473-848 as a tool with the MPCA enforcing it so that waste can be processed pursuant to the law prior to being landfilled. It is true this law has been on the book for 27 years, and please understand that in the metro area, the obligation was to not send any unprocessed ton to a landfill. That was the first obligation on the books. And with that as the obligation, the counties in the metro area spent over $300 million over the last 20-plus years building these waste energy facilities. And then, as you all know, the energy is part of our energy policy. It's renewable energy. Since that time, certain of our facilities are at less than full capacity. In fact, the facility up in Elk River, which is owned by a private entity, Great River Energy, is at about 50% capacity right now, and every day, hauler trucks drive right by its front door and take the waste to the Elk River landfill because it is much cheaper to landfill waste than to take it to a processor where it's going to be turned into renewable energy. There are all the air pollution control equipment in place and other equipment to make it a safe process and to thoroughly use the energy from the waste. So, frankly, a state-of-the-art facility can't compete with the pricing at a landfill, and landfills will always win. But in this state in 1980, we acted and said we need to process before we landfill, and that's in the state solid waste hierarchy. That applies to all counties statewide, including the metro area. There's plenty of waste in the metropolitan area. Actually, I think our rates show only about 40% recycling, and if all of our facilities were operating at capacity serving the metro area, we would only use up 20% of the waste. So there is a lot of tonnage out there that could go to Spruce Ridge, that could go to Elk River, or could go to the two landfills down in Dakota County. And none of us are trying to say, take it here, there, or elsewhere. All we're saying is that this capacity was built pursuant to the direction of this body, and it needs to be fully utilized. And it's a terrible waste of taxpayers' dollars if it's not fully utilized. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could say a few comments about the study proposed as it relates to the amendment, I would hope that if a study does go forwards, that it will be comprehensive. And some of the suggestions I would like to make is that it needs to include, for example, the estimates of the landfill capacity preserved. Let's be honest. We don't have much landfill capacity left in this state. And so that's a benefit, and that's something that should be valued if the waste instead is processed instead of put in a landfill. We should also evaluate the effect it would have on our solid waste hierarchy, the current law, on energy policy, We should probably measure increased landfill pollutants. You know, it's very frustrating for me, having represented all the waste energy facilities of the last 20 years, that we know exactly what we're emitting because it comes out of one stack. We have all the air pollution control equipment, and, Mr. Chairman, you know because you have one fabulous facility in your community. Landfills, we have no clue. We have some EPA studies, but, you know, there's a lot of unknowns. So why should we be prioritizing landfills and sending the waste there? And then waste sheds and hauling routes. I'm having a lot of difficulty. I mean, I feel for McLeod County, but I also know that most of the waste that could find a home could come out of the northeast and eastern and southeastern portion of the metro area, and there's no logical sense at all that that's waste impacting what's ultimately ending up at Spruce Ridge. There's plenty of waste to get to Spruce Ridge, and the haulers could work with Spruce Ridge and the community and make sure that happens without impacting this legislation that's so important to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think this is question is for this testifier, but the question is, the landfill at Spruce Ridge must require some sort of permitting from the PCA, I'm guessing. Is that correct? And maybe
somebody here that can testify to that, yes. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What was the question, Senator Carlson?
The question is, the landfill at Spruce Ridge does require some sort of permit from the PCA. Is that correct?
Senator Carlson, Mr. Chair, while I'm not an employee of the landfill out there, I know that they go through a permitting process. I'm not aware of that process. I know that we have a 20-year contract to purchase the energy that is produced from that facility. Fortunately,
maybe we can get someone from the MPC
here that can tell you the permitting process.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum. I work for Waste Management. We're the owner of the landfill, Spruce Ridge Landfill in McLeod County. And yes, our facility meets all state and federal standards for land disposal. So it does go through and has gone through the permitting process and has a specific permitted capacity that's allowed there.
Senator Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my follow-up question would be, if the MPCA gives a permit to this landfill to take this, all of this waste, without sorting and without, then how can they come back and say, well, now you have to? They already gave them a permit to take all of this stuff unsorted. And then now they want them that they can't take it if it's not sorted. It's really confusing.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Carlson, if I may. You know, the law was passed in 1985. It's 27 years old. A lot of things have changed since 1985. We have a very high recycling rate, and there's a lot of waste reduction. If you haven't noticed, your newspaper's gotten smaller, your the metal cans have gotten thinner. So there's a lot of things that have changed about the waste stream, and it's curious to me that at this point in time that the agency has moved forward with engaging the hauling community, the waste disposal community, counties on this issue of enforcing the mandatory processing statute when it's been there for 27 years and not enforced. So, yes, we have a permit for our facility. We're allowed to take that waste in. There's interest now. There's, as Trudy Richter referred to, there is a small margin of waste that doesn't go to processing facilities. It's about 200,000 tons out of the entire metro area. It's pretty small in comparison. And so we feel as a hauling community that material would be better if we recycle that material and work to pull out the organics and do organics composting. We think that's a better approach than tying it up in contracts at these facilities. And in fact, I'll note that the waste industry has signed contracts at all of these facilities, so we have worked for many years to ensure that waste gets to these facilities. There is one facility that is experiencing a shortfall.
Members, Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Peterson first. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator Peterson, then Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, you know, my experience in these issues is that the residents of the county generally work to try and reduce the amount of waste coming into their county, particularly when it's coming from somebody else's county, you know, because I think typically they don't want to be a dumping ground for. Am I understanding that correctly? In this situation, McLeod County is saying they want to continue to take waste from the metro area. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, it's my understanding that is correct, and that is reflected, excuse me, in the email that I received from the employee from McLeod County, who has been an employee of McLeod County for 30-plus years.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, has the county board and the township board in McLeod County taken a vote on this issue?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, not that I know of, but I would ask you to please keep in mind that that I've only been aware of this situation for a couple of days. Now, maybe Mr. Meyer is in a better position to answer that question.
Mr. Meyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, at our Light and Power Commission meeting last Monday night, we did have a representative from the McLeod County Commission, Commissioner Kermit Terlinden, came and spoke to us regarding this issue. He spoke to us regarding the concerns that the McLeod County commissioners have with the implementation of this statute in regard to how it affects not only their solid waste handling, but how it can potentially affect the gas-to-energy generation out there. I guess I would have to say that I honestly agree with the previous testimony that that things have changed so much and there should not be priorities going to any given place, whether it be in the metro or outside the metro. And I would suggest that this is something that should be tabled and looked at and studied before it's aggressively enforced.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question probably for the representative from the Solid Waste Association and for the person from Waste Management. Our county, I was a former county commissioner on a county that is in a joint powership with a incinerator. And one of the things that those group of counties has done is put in pre-separation where they're pulling out their aluminum and glass and cardboard, which wouldn't none of that would be making methane gas. And my recollection, and I can't recall, but my recollection when they showed me all what they were doing, they were pretty proud of it. And they thought it was actually, depending upon the market, of course, but it wasn't a cost center. It might actually make them some money when recycling for aluminum was good. And they were using the glass as a replacement for gravel on some of the roads, and they were selling the cardboard. Would that not be an option for this facility to put in some pre-processing and put the stuff in the ground that would make methane gas and sell the rest of it? I'm not sure I understand the economics of it, but maybe the two of you could enlighten me there.
Mr.
Berkopek.
Again, Mike Berkopek, Minnesota Chairman, National Solid Waste Management Association. I think the reason that we're here today and talking to you as policymakers is because this law is 27 years old, and there has been a lot of changes. And what you suggest, I think, is an opportunity, and I don't have any specific facts on it, but I do believe that those are things that are out there that different people have been doing. McLeod County is a good example of that. And I think the reason why we're supportive of this amendment is we think that those things need to be looked at very, very seriously before we take a 1985 position and put it into 2012.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, if I may answer your question as well. Yes, there have been a lot of changes within our industry, and pre-processing like that, while it is expensive, if the market commands that, if the rates can be can survive in a free market setting, then yes, pre-processing does make sense. There's a lot of things going on in the industry, and our company, Waste Management, is in the process of we've invested in many different new technologies that take organics and process organics and purify chemicals that can be considered green chemicals. That's just one really high-tech example. But there are also ways to pre-process construction and demo waste and recycle more of that material. And we're involved in some of that. We're taking out material at our transfer stations. Maple Grove transfer station, we're pulling out wood and cardboard and other types of materials. There has to be a market for that material. And any of that activity has to, the market has to be able to support it.
Well, Mr. Chair, and yes, absolutely, and I understand we're in a little economic downturn right now. Some of that stuff isn't doing as well as it has in the past, but wouldn't it meet the intent of the law to pre-process this waste? And if it isn't a huge cost item, I'm not understanding why we're not doing that. It would meet the intent of the law. McLeod County could make their methane and get their energy, and into the law would be met. I'm not tracking it.
Dr. Squire, before we move on, I think that the amendment to the amendment is what we should be talking about here, and then Senator Kielash. But it's pretty straightforward. 27 years this law has been passed. 27 years ago, nothing's been done. There's been no action taken. This amendment does not repeal that law. It just simply says let's take a deep breath here and deal with issues. I mean, very significant possible cost issues here that should be looked at that could be generated out of this all of a sudden enforcement after 27 years. So, members, that's pretty much what it is. Again, we're not repealing this. We're just simply saying let's take a look at it for a while and report back. I think it's pretty reasonable request. Senator Higgins.
And, Mr. Chair, I think information is generally good, but it doesn't say anywhere in here the effect of the metropolitan businesses and municipally or county-owned facilities and the effect it would have on them as well. I also think that the suggestions that Ms. Richter gave us of things to add in here would give us important information, and I'm asking Mr. Knopf if he can put together an amendment that would add those in. If we're going to get information, let's make sure that we have it for useful information about the whole process, not just the folks who are feeling like they may lose some business outside the metro area, but let's get the rest of the information too. And Mr. Knopf might not be ready for
that. I'm sorry. I actually skipped. I should have had Senator Kielash first. But while he's drawing that up, Senator Kielash, you have a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it seems like this is really recent to Senator Newman. And also, so I'm wondering if it's really ready for including in an omnibus bill like this without working the language. My question to Waste Management is has the PCA given you new direction, new enforcement things to do at this point in time, or just this is a concern for when they finally get all their new strategy or whatever to start enforcing this together? So I'm kind of a little confused as to whether or not the enforcement has started, and that's disrupting you, or if you're just concerned that the enforcement will disrupt your methane. So.
Senator, Chairman, there's not a specific thing today, but as a small business, a hauler in the community, we're very concerned about all the different changes that are out there, and we really do believe that we need to spend some time thinking this, because obviously the legislature passed this bill 27 years ago, but before we start enforcing it, I think it's very important that policymakers make sure they understand exactly what's going to be enforced. And we have been working with the PCA
for a couple of years now. We've met with them several times, and we want to continue to work with them to figure this out.
Mr. Chair, can I follow?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, no, the agency has not begun enforcement of this issue. They have. They did start talking about it 2 years ago when they began drafting the Metropolitan Solid Waste Policy Plan. Our association commented on that plan in December of 2010 and met with the commissioner in January of 2011, and the plan was signed off last April of 2011. So, and from then on, the metro counties have worked to develop their regional solid waste master plan, which contains a need to enforce mandatory processing. So it's been a march of 2 years where it's become pretty clear that that's the direction the agency is heading in. So while they haven't officially begun enforcement, they've shown their intention now for quite some time.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I guess I'm pretty inclined to support this study, but I would like to include in it, because we were talking about this law that's been around for 27 years, well, there are counties that, when this law was passed, took action to comply with it. I mean, the county that I live in and a number of the surrounding counties formed a joint powers board and built an incinerating plant and pre-separate and use the power to do other industry. They dry vegetables and do all kinds of things with the energy that's made. So there are counties out there that have done this, and part of the study ought to be the implication to those facilities. I understand the metropolitan counties have spent, somebody said, $300 million. Well, we ought to take a look at that.
Yes.
You know, but also the other thing I do want to say, one of the counties in our joint powers board was going to be kind of the, I don't know how to call it, the fudge county or whatever, when there was not enough demand for the incinerator from the core counties, this other county was going to deliver to the incinerator to help fill up the need. And what has happened, and as we've heard today in testimony, landfill wins every time. And so this county that had flexibility in whether it went to the incinerator or the landfill hardly ever takes anything to the incinerator. It always goes to the landfill because it's cheaper. But it also might not be the best for the state. And so, you know, we got to kind of, this would be really good information. And I'd be curious to see what kind of information. But I'd also like to see if there wasn't some data that could come of, you know, in the 87 counties, what are people doing? And how much is it costing them? And is it a fair price that people are paying for solid waste disposal?
Thanks for that. I think you're right. I think that'd be certainly a fair question to ask the MPCA. They should have record of that, I would think. Somebody else had a question. I'm sorry. Oh, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Ms. Richter. Earlier you mentioned that there's a facility, maybe a waste energy or incinerator, that there's trucks driving by that going to a landfill because of the rates. Can you just give us an idea of what the difference is in rates from maybe that facility to the landfill? And just rough estimate would be great.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, the facility I was referencing was the Great River Energy Facility in Elk River, Minnesota. And the haulers that are driving past its front door are taking it, we believe, to the Elk River landfill, which is a waste management landfill. I'm not sure what their gate rate is, but I understand they have a variety of rates depending on who you are. So I can't speak to the landfill rate. But the hauling rate has been, or the facility rate, my recollection is it's in the $80 range.
At
the waste energy facility.
Okay.
But some incorrect information was provided that I'd like to correct. And one is that is not the only facility that is short on capacity. Xcel Energy had made an investment with the counties over 20 years ago with two of their facilities were retrofitted. One is in the city of Red Wing, and the other is in Mankato. It's called the Wilmarth facility. Both those facilities have excess capacity, and the waste needs to come to them via the Ramsey and Washington counties to Newport, Minnesota, where it's turned into refuse-derived fuel and then carted down. So there are more facilities that are in need of waste than was represented. And I'd also like to make sure everybody did get to see what the PCA did pass out to correct the amount of waste in the metro area that is still available and being landfilled. Based on what you see here, in 2010, it appears that less waste is going to waste energy and there's still more going to landfill. In other words, well over 800,000 tons still is landfilled out of the metropolitan area, even though 200,000 rate was provided to you, which is not correct.
Okay,
thank
members,
you.
Okay, members, we have to move on. Senator Higgins has an amendment here she'd like to have looked at.
Mr. Knopf.
Knopf.
Mr. Chair and members, what would be is on line of the amendment now, line 1.20, delete the and then we're going to insert four new clauses. Number 7 will be an estimate of the landfill capacity preserved. Number 8 will be an estimate of the pollution reduction from decreased landfilling, the effect on the solid waste management hierarchy and energy policy, the effect on waste sheds and hauling routes. And then we'll insert an and, and we'll make number 7 11. There'll be 11 items in the report.
Ms. Richter, did I get the language right that we translated to Mr. Knopf?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Go ahead.
And does it also include the information that Senator Scoy wanted about all the counties giving information about
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, no, it would not. The problem is this is in Chapter 473, which only applies to the metropolitan counties. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this study would have to include Chapter 400, where a similar study was done with the non-metro counties to see what they have done as it relates to the hierarchy and using processing to respond instead of landfilling.
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, and it's I hope this is a friendly amendment, but I would I hope you can consider looking at the impacts of all facilities and looking at including all types of disposal facilities in that have MSW or have processed MSW. So you're looking at ash landfills as well.
Senator Saxog, to the amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would there be any fiscal ramifications on this?
Well, that's part of what the study is going to be doing here, showing. And I think there's some fiscal possibilities here that may be.
Not with the study.
Not with the study. What the findings of the study, is that what you're talking about? I'm sorry.
Well, I was kind of wondering about the study itself.
The cost to do the study.
Yeah. Cost of the study.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxog, this bill, if this amendment goes on the bill, the whole bill is going to the Finance Committee, and I'm going to get a new fiscal note for the whole bill. I've got fiscal notes or preliminary ones for different parts of the bill, but
that's what we've been requested as well.
Okay.
So yes.
The PCA, I'm sure, will take a look at this with that.
Okay. I should ask the other parties involved, does it sound like that amendment would be satisfactory? Reasonable? Okay. Okay, you want to explain describe the amendment? Senator Dietzick, did you have a question? Somebody did on the end.
I just had a follow-up. If I could get the other half of my answer maybe from Ms. Kirchham on the tipping or the rates at the landfill, just
sure.
Real brief what the average rate is.
Senator Miller, it's my understanding that the tip fee rate at Great River Energy, the processing facility, is $53 a ton right now. And at our landfill, it's somewhere between $30 and $35 per ton. So you're looking at $20 per ton, a difference. So if you're a small hauler and, say, you hauled 20,000 tons to Elk River Landfill, the impact on your hauling company, if you were required by the agency to send it to a processing facility, is going to be somewhere around $325,000, $350,000 a year. Increased costs.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr.
Chair and Senator,
Julie's talking about me. I am the Ace Solid Waste is the largest contractor that goes to the Great River Energy Plant. I think we have the largest commitment to the Great River Energy Plant. We also go to the Elk River Landfill. So the difference that she describes is true and real, and obviously if that happens, somehow, somewhere, a cost like that has to get covered.
Okay. Is that net after three?
Any further questions about the Higgins Amendment? Higgins Amendment, and I think we should probably repeat it again before we take action.
Mr. Chair, if that's your wish, we're going to add four new clauses to the report requirements, and the first one will be an estimate of the landfill capacity preserved, and the next one is an estimate of the pollution reduction from decreased landfilling. The next one is the effect on the solid waste management hierarchy and energy policy, and the fourth is the effect on waste sheds and hauling routes.
Members, any further questions to the amendment to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, didn't the testifier suggested all facilities as well? Do we want to add that to it? All waste management facilities, so it included everything. Can you just add that to the? I think that's what you said.
It's actually on line 12.
I think it's on line 12. You said.
Might be. There's existing county solid waste programs there already.
I guess that's already covered.
Already covered? Yeah. Thank you.
To the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign? Good. Okay. We are to the point where we've had some tremendous discussion, I think, here.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Adopt the amendment.
That's what I was doing. I'm going to adopt the A2 amendment.
Sorry.
Any further discussion? The A2 amendment. Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign? Hey, members, any further testimony at all to the Senate file 1830 as amended? Mr. Kudelka.
Cheers, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and committee members, again, Kirk Kudelka for the record from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Just some quick comments on the overall amendment is where we're at. Just real quick on the previous amendment, there may need to be some additional information we'd like to bring forward. If MPCA is required to report additional things, where waste is coming from, what the sources of information, which we may have suggestions at a later date. Having just seen this a couple minutes ago, we may have some additional input on it. On the A1 amendment overall, we just wanted to highlight some of the pieces. On the concrete slurry sections 43 and 54, this is something that the agency has some concern with.
Give us the pages real quick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
29.
A little bit more help that way.
29.
Mr. Chair, committee members, section 43 is on page 29, and section 54 is on page 37. Okay. This deals with the concrete slurry disposal. The agency, as we testified previously, are working with the stakeholders on this issue. The current language, we do have some concerns on technical basis on how it's written. It would allow for the disposal of this substance that isn't necessarily best management practices and at the site to be disposed of anywhere in the state in various ways. We do have some concerns with that. And we will continue to work with the industry on some BMPs on this because, in the end, if it is disposed of in an incorrect manner on-site or off-site, there are concerns with water pollution issues. Even though, again, concrete may be on the benign end of things, there is still concern because once it gets into the water column, it can create problems. But we're committed to work with the author of the bill and also the industry on finding a solution that works for MnDOT and MPCA. And then on
Senator Gazelka has a question. For that
thank point. You, Mr. Chair. To that point, when you're doing the research, I guess I'm going to want to know, this was common practice in the past, if there was any environmental problems that are recorded back then, because it is quite a bit less expensive for us to do it the way it was done.
Continue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to highlight on a couple other parts. Section 73 of the bill dealing with the SSTS language, page 45. The bill was heard the other day, and we testified to some concerns as it's written, and we floated out an idea of a soft deadline for enforcement of the April 4th deadline. And just to let folks know, the agency is moving forward at this point, drafting letters to allow this soft deadline on April 4th so that initial drafts of plans could be submitted. It would allow tank manufacturers to move forward then and have a longer date out into the year to finish that work. We are looking in the range of possibly October or a little later. We're still finalizing that detail to allow some flexibility to tank manufacturers. When that letter does go out, that is something the agency is going to need to do soon, since there's an April 4th deadline. We would, once that's in writing, would like to see this language be removed from the bill, if that's okay, as it does create other problems with other deadlines that have gone and passed, and we've already have closure on the issue. Just some other notes real quick. The MPCA policy bill was mentioned earlier in a number of these sections. There are a couple items that were not in the MPCA, that are in the MPCA policy bill, but not in the delete all amendment. And some of that deals with our score report changes. In 2009, the legislature required the agency to work with a number of local government stakeholders on changing the report to make the burdens on local government less onerous. We've done that work and did a report in 2010 on the issue, and some of those suggestions are not in this amendment. We've heard from other stakeholders with some concerns. We've met with them, and we'll be working on other language to try to create a policy that everyone can agree with. So we'll continue to move forward on that and may have language at a later date to supply. The same goes with the changes in our toxic and pollution prevention report. There is some concern on language. Again, that change is not in the bill. We'll continue to work with those with concerns and would like to at a later date come forward with language on the issue. Those are our major concerns. I know we share some of the other concerns dealing with wetland changes with other agencies, and we'll continue to work with folks on those issues.
Thank you for that. And yes, I'd be more than happy to work with you with these issues as we move forward, Mr. Kadelka. This has at least two more stops for sure. I think in two or one, for sure it's got to go to finance.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I think the thought was that this would be sent directly to finance. The bill you sent out on Tuesday, 1839, was going to judiciary. There are some judiciary issues in here, but the thought was that they would be dealt with. All those issues, the issues that are dealing with judiciary in this bill are also in 1839, so that they would be dealt with in that bill, and this bill would go directly to finance.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Julie Blackburn. I'm Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I just want to provide a couple of comments on some of the sections contained in this omnibus bill. First of all, I want to say that we are very pleased with sections 23 through 33. That is the changes made to the comprehensive local water management and watershed management planning. This has been 2 years' worth of work that local governments have been putting into watershed-based planning, and we believe that that is a very good section of this bill, and we're happy to see it in there. As far as some of the Wetland Conservation Act changes, our main concern still, under Section 35, which would be on page 25, the changes on 25.16 to 25.20, we still think those are not necessary, but we do agree to the compromise that's been put in place, although we really haven't had any reasons for this to be changed. But, you know, we can live with the way that it is. Although we are referencing a federal code, again, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the smartest state policy to have. As far as the de minimis requirements, Bowser certainly acknowledges that the de minimis exemptions are probably the most complicated portion of WACA, extremely complicated. We have different kinds of worksheets that help people understand how their impacts to wetlands need to be offset if they're over this de minimis exemption. So we appreciate the desire to streamline and make it more efficient. But along with that, we want to make sure that we aren't losing any of the protections that are in place. The overall changes to the de minimis exemptions basically have the most effect on two different regions, and that region is in the immediate setback area, the building setback area of the shoreline zone, where the protection has changed from 20 square feet to 100 square feet of impact. And in the metropolitan area, there are two different major impacts that have doubled the exemption limits, and that is in the 50 to 80% area of the metropolitan, which would be in the northeastern portion of the 11-county metro area. Outside of the shoreline zone, the de minimis has changed from 2,500 square feet to 5,000 square feet. And in the less than 50% area of the 11-county metro area, which would be in the south and southwest, the area outside of the shoreline zone has increased from 1,000 square feet to 2,000 square feet. So both those cases, we've more than doubled or more than doubled the de minimis exemption, which does have impacts to wetlands in the metropolitan area. The way that the bill is written, it eliminates the metropolitan requirement. And again, I understand that that's part of streamlining. We just still do have some concerns with that. As far as the Section 37 on line 2718, I do 2717 and 2718, I do understand you made that oral amendment, right, to remove the language that says pursuant to a written wetland violation complaint. That's been changed, correct? Okay, that's good. That would be very, very difficult for us to work with. So just wanted to let you know the agency's concerns and also that we do appreciate some of the portions of this bill as well.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Any further questions on the bill? Senator Higgins.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. I know that omnibus bills are sometimes far-ranging, but I've never seen one that had the phrase yacht club and viral hemorrhagic septicemia in the same
one. Just when you think you've seen it all, Senator Higgins, there's something that comes out. It's just amazing, this place we work in. Any further questions? Hearing none, I guess I have to move the bill. I move Senate File 1830 as amended and re-referred to the Senate Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Thank you, members, for the discussion. Stand adjourned.